You're listening to Kelly Martin Speaks. I'm your host, Kelly, and the co-producer of Shining Bright Radio, author, blogger, and recovering darkness addict. I've experienced intense anxiety, deep depression, and life trauma, but I'm coming out of the other side now. Darkness was a comfort zone for me for a long time, and it felt safer than the light. So in this podcast, I share with you my journey into the light and how I move through challenge in an empowering way. I'll share with you tools and nurturing ways to embrace your humanity, and I'll bring along inspirational teachers to support your journey too. I was once a shy, scared introvert, afraid to speak, but that's all changing. Let's take this journey together and learn to fly. You're about to listen to a very inspirational and deep conversation. Pour a cup of tea, relax, and enjoy. Hi, welcome back to Kelly Martin Speaks, formerly known as Podcast for the Soul. This is episode 7, and this is my first ever interview on the podcast. And I'm a bit nervous, and so is my guest, so bear with us. So hello to Michael Doherty, one of my greatest friends. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hi there, Kelly. How are you today?
I'm okay. I'm a bit nervous. As you know, I suffer from anxiety and this is all new to me. But the reason I wanted to interview Michael is he's a retired maths and physics teacher. He's the author of The I Ching, a unique interpretation of the Book of Changes. And he's generally someone that I tend to call my wise Yoda friend, who is a no bullshit human being. So would you agree with that, Michael?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I'm sure it doesn't make me a lot of friends, but yeah, you're right.
You're one of my best friends, so I had to have you on first for the interviews. So now I've known you for around 15 years, and before we met, I'd never heard of the I Ching. So as a beginner, what is the I Ching and how on earth did you become interested in it, especially as you're a scientist?
There are different ways of trying to understand the world. In the West, our scientific method is to break things down into their smallest parts, find out how they work, and then put them back together to explain reality. The Chinese, in particular, in some respects, many of the Asian nations had an entirely different explanation of reality, a different way of approaching it. Instead of breaking things down into their smallest parts and then trying to understand it from there, the Eastern idea is to look at it holistically, look at it from the top down. For example, in the West, if a biologist or a botanist wanted to understand a flower, they would pick the flower, which incidentally would kill it, and then they would take it apart, take the leaves off, and take all the stamens and everything out and examine it under microscopes and try to understand how the flower worked, which is a bit difficult when, in fact, they killed it at the beginning. But the Eastern idea is entirely different. You don't pick the flower because it's alive. You observe it. You meditate on it. If possible, the sages, the masters, were able to become the flower, to form a connection with the flower so that they could experience what being a flower was like. The I Ching is an ancient understanding of the world. It's about 5,000 years old, and it began at the time of the Emperor Fuxi, who is purported to be the first emperor of the Chinese nation, which at that time was split up into various small states, which were joined together, eventually to form China. Now, Fuxi is said to have examined the heavens, to examine the earth, to examine everything, to observe everything, and to try to understand how everything worked together. And he came up with the idea of that there were eight basic forms of energy which could explain the world. Everything in the world was based upon or influenced by these eight forms of energy. And this is how the I Ching began. And these eight forms of energy were given names like heaven, earth, mountain, wind, water, fire. Not to say that the mountain energy was a mountain, but that it was the stillness of the mountain. It was the characteristic of the mountain which could explain certain aspects of life. And he took these eight, and later on, a couple of thousand years later, a king, King Wen of the Zhou dynasty in China, combined these eight energies together and formed 64 what are called hexagrams. And it was suggested that these 64 hexagrams, which could be split into six parts, producing 384 typical situations, could explain every situation which occurred in life in general and in one's personal aspect. It was really based upon the fact that everything in the universe operates in cycles. There are the typical cycles that we're aware of. There's spring, summer, autumn, winter. There's the days of the week. There's the hours of the clock. But the whole universe operated in cycles. And by using and studying the I Ching, it would be possible to find out where you were in any particular cycle. And the I Ching didn't tell you what to do. What it did was to suggest the best possible outcome from whatever situation you were in. And it became an oracle that was used by the ancients and is still in use in modern China and in also in Japan, in Taiwan, in most of the nations of the East. It's still used for guidance by the military, by governments. As to how I became involved in it, yes, my basic education and my basic interest was science and mathematics, but I realised, no, let's go back. As a child, I had what could be considered to be a dysfunctional childhood in spades, and I was looking for answers. I wanted to know why my life, my childhood life, was so terrible, really, in many ways, with most forms of abuse. And yet I saw around me kids of my age who seemed to be living a very happy life in happy families. And I was looking for answers. And I won't go into any details of the searches I did into the various faiths, religions, etc. But a very, very wise man gave me the I Ching, the book, the I Ching, for my 14th birthday. And when I opened it up, there was this ancient flowery language, which had been translated into English, but it was still pretty arcane and pretty flowery. And he could see on my face that I didn't have a clue what I was looking at. And he said to me, "Don't worry about that. Give it 30 years and you'll understand why I gave you this." So that's where my interest really came from. And I've been studying it on and off, and over the past 20 years, mainly on, because to me, it holds answers to the fundamental questions, and it is also the Chinese explanation of reality, as opposed to the Western scientific one.
Wow, that's really deep and intensity again, but I know how much it's affected you and helped you in life. Now, I know that you're a retired maths and physics teacher. How does that actually combine, because many people listening might wonder, how on earth can you be into Chinese philosophy when you're a maths and a physics teacher?
Okay. If we think of the human brain, which is divided into two parts, the left brain and the right brain, the left brain is the seat of logic, which is where the maths and science obviously would be based. There is another way of looking at the world as a holistic thing, a whole, without breaking it up into parts. And this is the area of the activity of the right brain. Now, I knew a bit later on that because I was so involved in the maths and science side of things, I was very unbalanced. And I needed to, if you like, raise the activity of the right brain to bring it more into balance with the excessively active left brain. And over the years of studying this philosophy, as well as the Indian Vedic philosophy, I realized that I would be able to form a bridge between the two and perhaps be able to explain both sides to people who wanted to know.
Yeah, because I know that you're very intuitive, and you've tried to teach me the I Ching as best you can, because you know I'm interested in a lot of other different things. But one thing I liked about your book is the fact that it's very simple. And you talk about the ego quite a lot in there. And I was just wondering, I know a lot of teachers talk about getting rid of the ego. Is it even possible to get rid of the ego? And what are the benefits of the ego?
Okay. The ego is really an illusion. It's not real. It's based upon memories. It's based upon, for example, when you're presented with a new situation, do we actually respond to that situation from the place of something new, or do we refer back to similar situations in our past, in our memory bank? And this is what the ego does. And it also wants to try to control the future, which is a pretty pointless exercise. So the ego is really based upon the past and fears the future. It cannot exist in this now moment. And the ego is scared of this now moment, because if one becomes practiced in meditation, in mindfulness, in experiencing life through the now moment, then the ego hasn't got a job to do. As for your question about destroying the ego, this isn't possible. We need an ego. We need a personality in order to be able to interact with other people. And when some supposedly wise people say that, the point of meditation is to destroy the ego, the crazy thing is that you're asking the ego to destroy itself, because that's all you can use. So you're using, or at least you think you can use the ego to destroy the ego. And believe me, it ain't having any of it. Because even if you succeed in chopping off the ego's head, another 10 grow. And it's very, very capable at sliding in through the back door.
I know that too well.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
And so really, is it more about allowing, not letting the ego control us, and just becoming aware of what we're doing and what the choices we're making in life?
Okay. I suppose the best way of looking at it is we need an ego. We need to be able to interact. We need the thinking processes, and they are fine if they're our servant. If they become our master, they can cause tremendous damage.
Yeah, definitely. Now I'm going to give away one of your secrets now. I know you don't want me to talk about this, but I know that you're turning about, is it 81 years old this year?
Yeah.
I know you never like mention your age, but I do really think that the length of time you've been on this planet gives you some great knowledge and experience to share. So with the I Ching, and generally in life, how do you feel that the I Ching has helped you with all of your past, your difficulties? Have you got any stories or examples you can give on how the I Ching has benefited you in your life?
Okay, I think really if we look at how the I Ching is structured, it starts off from the fact that before there was anything, before there was anything manifested, any, if you like, before the Big Bang, there was the potential for creation. And this, the Chinese call this the Yang force, the positive force. But if we think about the idea of God or the source, I don't like the word God, it's got too much religious baggage attached to it. But if we think of the idea of the source, then the source is everything. And because the source is everything, there is nothing outside of it. There is nothing opposite to it. Now, in order to experience anything, we need the opposites. I can't experience heat without being aware of cold. There's no such thing as up without down. And actually, and this is what causes a lot of people problems, there's no such thing as good without evil. They are two energies, two opposing energies. And we need opposing energies. We need opposites. We need contrast in order to be able to experience anything. Now, it reminds me of a Sufi story. The Sufi are the Islamists. They're basically from the religion of Islam. But every religion has got a split-off group which doesn't believe that you need priests or other people to contact whatever, we'll call it God. They believe that we can only contact it through ourselves. And the Sufis came up with lots of stories to try to get people to not understand, but to feel reality. And the story they use to teach children about God, I find is very powerful, but also quite amusing. They say that, you know, God is everything. God is everywhere. He is infinite in both space and time. So as he's everywhere, he can't go anywhere, which is a bit off-putting. And also he has the whole of eternity. And he's got no mate. He's up there on his own. And he can't experience anything because there's nothing opposite. But God did have one thing that he could use, and that was he could create things. So he created this virtual reality that we live in, a reality of opposites. And he did that, or God did that, the source did that, in order to experience. So you could look at it that life is about, on the earth at the moment, we're all one, that's the thing. That's the important thing. We're all just one thing. We're all this energy. But we think we're separate people. We have got this idea of separation from the one. And this separation is the cause of our suffering. The separation is the ego. It develops from when we are born. We learn to react to situations in a particular way in order to survive. For example, a baby needs its adult, its parents, in order to survive, to provide it with the nutrition, the care that it needs in order to survive. And this is where the ego begins. This is where the child begins to get this idea that he is separate or she is separate. And the ego develops this idea, because as the child's life goes on, it gets more and more memories, more and more experience. But it gets this idea that it is separate, that it is alone against the world. And this is where it all comes from. And actually, if we look at Christianity, if we look at the Bible and the Garden of Eden story, everything was fine in the Garden of Eden until the serpent came along and got Eve to encourage Adam to eat the apple of the tree of knowledge. And also, because this, I believe the Bible says that this would give Adam the concepts of good and evil. But one of the other things that's quite powerful in this Bible story, which is just a parable, but nevertheless it's still true, is that Adam named everything in the Garden of Eden. Before that, there were no names. There was just the one. As soon as you name something, you separated it.
So that's when we label everything, that's where it causes problems. We identify too much with everything.
Yeah. Well, we identify with the fact that we're separate from everything, because once you look around and you say, that's a tree, that's a house, that's a building, that's a car, by doing that, you are separating yourself from everything.
I think I talked to you recently about the teacher Osho and how he said that if you look at a flower in the morning and then you look at a flower in the afternoon, it's a completely different flower. But we tend to fixate on what we think that flower is. We label it, what it looks like, what it smells like. And I think that's what we do about people as well. We expect too much of ourselves and other people, and we just label everybody around us. And I think we get into difficulties with relationships because of that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, because as soon as we name something, as soon as we define something, we've defined its opposite automatically. For example, as soon as we define the colour red, we've defined everything that isn't red, in effect. So Osho is a Sufi, to use that word again, it is a Sufi master, or was a Sufi master. And he believed that nothing was fixed. As soon as I identify something, as soon as I define it, I fixed it. Whereas the book you mentioned, Yi Ching, is called the Book of Change, because the only thing that is permanent in the universe is change. Nothing stays the same. And one of the problems is that we tend to, particularly in our personal relationships, we tend to identify a person as a certain thing that doesn't change. Whereas in fact, people change by the second.
Yeah, and we try to think of them as the person we used to know rather than who they've become. I know that we've had experience of this, you know, when you've had maybe family or friends for a long time, and then you start to grow and change, and they're still viewing you on the person you used to be, and it can cause all sorts of problems, can't it?
Okay, I think Shakespeare summed it up when he suggested that life was a stage. A play, if you like. And in this play, in the play of our lives, let's consider a play. A play has got a script. Each person has got a particular role. And provided they act as they are supposed to according to the script and speak the lines, then the play can continue. So if you've got a couple or a group of people, provided each person behaves and speaks in the way that they're expected to, then there are no problems. But if one of those people begins to change, begins to grow and change their attitudes, then what they're doing, they're working from a different script. So if you can imagine somebody walking on stage and start spouting off in lines that are not in the play's script, then the play's finished. And this is the problem in groups or relationships. If one person begins to change, then unless it's done gradually and with understanding of the other people, then that relationship is going to break down.
Definitely. Now, I'm going to get back to my question earlier, because it was really fascinating listening to you, so I got lost in that. But with the I Ching, for you personally, how has it benefited you emotionally, physically? Just as you know, you've lived on this planet for nearly 81 years now. How has it benefited you over the years? How have you grown as a person because of it? And just in case anybody's listening and they're thinking about looking into the I Ching and developing themselves or learning about who they are through it.
Okay. I think the first and most important thing that that worked for me was the fact that nothing stays the same. So it meant that when I was going through difficult periods, I didn't get bogged down too much with the idea that this is the way it is, that's it. I realised that whatever situation if I was in a bad situation, it would change. It would turn to its opposite in time. But also, if I was in a good situation, it would change to its opposite in time, because everything is a cycle. It goes through a period of, it's like spring, summer, autumn, winter. It goes through a period of the seed will grow. It will grow during the spring into the summer when it will reach its maximum. And then it will go through a period of contraction, slowing down, and eventually it would die and be reborn, if you like, at the next spring. Everything goes through cycles. And I think one of the most important intuitions, if you like, it gave me was the fact that by using the I Ching, I could find out where I was in a cycle. So, for example, if I was in the autumn or winter part of a particular cycle in my life, then there was no point in putting effort in trying to make things work, because it wasn't at that part of the cycle. You know, it would be like in the middle of winter trying to encourage plants to grow. They're locked underground for a reason. They're not dead. Okay, we look out on a winter scene and it appears that everything's dead, but in fact, beneath the soil, there is a lot going on. There is a lot of potential there ready for rebirth and regrowth in the spring. So I think that's one of the things which gave me a lot of understanding. And another thing it taught me was that people basically do what they believe is right. Just as an aside, as I said, I had a particularly bizarre childhood. And I went through a period in my life where I blamed everything on my parents, on everybody else, if you like. And it wasn't until later that I began to realise that I was responsible for everything that had happened in my life, that my parents did what they believed was right for me. Even though it wasn't right for me, it was right for them at the time. Now, this meant that I was able to get to the point where I could forgive them. But then, in studying the I Ching in part and psychology in other parts, I realised that if they were only doing what they believed was right, then there was nothing to forgive. And I think that was quite a mind-blowing moment. And also, it gave me the idea that perhaps I hadn't been dealt a difficult hand by the universe. I'd been given exactly the life experience I needed as a child in order to become who I am today. And in spite of what many people think of me, I'm quite happy with who I am today.
Yes, I know that's one thing I like about that, that you don't really care what anybody thinks of you. And there's a rare human being like that. I mean, I think a lot of people would like to not care what other people think about them, but we do to some degree. Our egos get involved in everything. And it is pretty hard to not care what other people think of you. So I mean, how do you get to that stage in life where you don't care?
Okay. I think that... Okay, let's consider the idea of your reputation. I think this is a very good way of looking at it, your reputation. Let's say that I might know, say, 100 people, or have known 100 people in my life. At one end of that spectrum, there may be a few, perhaps 5 or 6, who think I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread, that I'm absolutely wonderful. But at the other end of that spectrum, there's probably a much larger number of people who think I'm a complete tosser, total waste of space. And in between, you've got 80 or 90 people who are along that spectrum. Some think, yeah, all right, he's all right, and some think, no, he's not. So there are 100 different opinions of me. Now, the important thing to realise is that I cannot change any of them. So my reputation is not a single thing. I have a different reputation with every single person I meet. And that means that what people think of me is theirs. It's none of my business. And I think that is a very, very good anchor to consider. So, there are a lot of people who say, oh, I don't care what people think. There are fewer of them, fewer of us, who really mean it.
You also mentioned just there about feeling, you felt like you're responsible for what happened in your life. Could you kind of expand on that? Because a lot of people might think, how can I be responsible for abuse or trauma that happened to me? Can you? I know a lot of people might not be able to get their heads around that.
Okay. If I go back to when I was around about the 14-year-old mark, and I've been looking for answers, I came to the conclusion that there were three possibilities: that either this universe was totally random and that life was a chemical accident that just happened, and that the situation that I'd found myself in was totally random. That was one way of looking at it, which I found a bit horrific, and it didn't really gel with what I knew about life. The second thing was that there was a God up there who was looking down and having a good laugh, really. A bit of a sick joke, and because I did note that if I got to the point where I thought I'd suss things out about life, if this God was out there, then he threw a great rock at me and said, dig that one out. That's another way of looking at it. But the third way that I looked at it was, what if before I came into this world, I chose this experience in order to, if you like, as a series of lessons. And if that were the case, then I was responsible. I'm not saying that, I take your point, I'm not saying that as a baby I was responsible for abuse or anything like that. But what I'm saying is that I as a higher self, if you like, not my ego, chose this experience for particular reasons. And I think that by accepting responsibility, by accepting that, okay, I chose this, then it took the sting out of it to a great extent. But it also meant that, okay, there's a problem here. People will come back and say, ah, yes, but in order to believe that, you've got to believe in reincarnation, you've got to believe that you were around beforehand. And my answer to that is, that way of looking at life works, whether or not there's reincarnation, whether or not I chose to come into this or not, doesn't matter. It is still the best way of living, the least suffering, if you like.
I think I was talking to somebody recently, because you know that I've experienced a lot of depression and anxiety in my life, and I know that you've experienced it too. And I jokingly said that I think in another lifetime, I had a really easy ride. And I think my soul realized that I wasn't really learning much. I wasn't really growing. I wasn't really expanding. So before I came into this life, I thought, right, okay, I'm going to have a bit more difficulty this time and see how I grow and see what happens from there. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, that's a good point, because if you think about it, the only time we grow is when things are difficult. There's no need to change. If everything's going great, there's no need to change. You don't actually learn anything when things are going well. You know, you say, well, why am I going to change? You know, for God's sake, everything's fine. You know, I've got all the money I need. I've got the friends I need. I've got the big house, the car, the yacht, the private jet, whatever. If everything's going well, you don't change. The only time you change is when you're up against it. And unfortunately, unless we understand that, or unless we feel that, then we don't look upon change as a positive thing. We don't look upon difficulty as a positive thing. And because of that, we don't change. So what life tends to do is to give you the same experience over and over and over again until you do change.
Yeah, how true, Michael. Do you think that's why we're having so many challenges in the world with politics and finance and everything? I don't want to go into the exact specifics. We're not going to talk politics. But do you think that's why we're having such big personalities come forward and cause so much conflict and stress among a lot of people?
Okay. I think that there has been a period of a couple of thousand years of patriarchy, everything dominated by the male energy, and it's reaching an extreme. And the I Ching teaches that when things reach an extreme, it flips over into its opposite. And I think we're going through a period when the male patriarchal power-based society is becoming more and more extreme throughout the world. And as you say, without commenting on particular personalities, it's so obvious. And what these sort of dictator-type people don't realise is that every dictatorship in history has collapsed. As soon as it's reached an extreme, it has collapsed. And I think we're going through the process now in the world that we're at or nearly at that totally extreme position where things are going to flip over. And that means that you cannot get the new, whatever it is, until the old has disintegrated. And we are going through the beginnings of the process of the disintegration of the patriarchy. And it's a bit like I was talking about my left brain being very, very active and my right brain virtually nothing in the beginning. It's the same thing. We're in a situation which is male-dominated. By male, I mean the masculine energy. But I think we're beginning to see the build-up of the feminine energy. Women are becoming more vocal. They are challenging the systems. I mean, we're seeing it with the Me Too movement of women saying no more, this ain't going to happen anymore. I think we're seeing a balance coming about. And you've got to understand that the masculine energy, the males who are in a dominant position, are scared. They know that things are going to change deep down. And they're frightened, and because of that, they're going to get more and more violent. They're going to become more and more dictatorial. But that will merely accelerate the change.
So what talking about masculine and feminine, what do you think the new role for man is then, as everything's changing and women are becoming, stepping more into their power? How do you see the male species, how do you see them changing or adapting? What is the best way to be a man in this changing reality?
Okay. I think we've got to go back to the 1960s to see the beginning of this, because really men now are in trouble. They're losing their role in life as women become more powerful, taking on their power. Men's power is being taken away from them. And if we go back to the wars, the First and Second World Wars, in both those wars, the men were required to go and fight. The women had to do the work that the men originally did. And once the war was over, they weren't prepared to go back to being slaves and servants. And as my father used to say, women should be kept barefooted and pregnant. It no longer works like that. And the interesting thing was, you could see the change really take place in the late 50s, 1960s, when the contraceptive pill was developed. The contraceptive pill finally, after thousands and thousands of years, gave women the power to control their own fertility. And that was the beginning of the breakdown of masculine power. And the thing is that men, I mean, we've got a situation, whether it's chemical or otherwise, whether it's the environment, the chemicals in the environment, male fertility is dropping at an alarming rate. Yes, men's ability to create the next generation is falling off, even amongst younger men now. It's caused by the fact, or at least one of the causes, is the fact that in the environment, many, many of the chemicals are very, very similar to the hormone estrogen. And this is causing within men a breakdown of the testosterone, which is the masculine hormone. And it's showing up in many, many ways. And you can see it. You can see it in the area where we live, for example. There are more and more violent outbursts from men against women. There's more violence against women. And this is because men are beginning to lose their idea of what they're here for, really. I think we're moving towards a matriarchal society. There was one originally, at the time I'm talking about, 5,000 years ago at the time of the I Ching, society was matriarchal. And if we go back to the Amazonian type of women, men were kept around for two reasons. One was to produce the next generation, and the other reason they were kept was to lift heavy stuff.
So how do you feel that men have got to be now? Have they got to find a new identity, a new way of living in this world? I can imagine, as you said, it's really difficult right now. So I can imagine there's a big identity crisis among a lot of men. How do they move forward?
I think the thing is that there's been an imbalance. And I think that imbalance has been because, I mean, in my childhood, for example, men don't cry. Men don't do all the things that women do. That's the woman's job. But I think that that's breaking down. And I think that men have got to try to accept their femininity. We are a balance. I mean, if you think about it, in the womb, in the first few weeks of pregnancy, there is no male, it is just female. The embryo is female, totally. It isn't until, I think it's about 10 weeks into the pregnancy, that for some of them, some of these female embryos, there's a hormone change and they flip into developing the male characteristics. So really, we all start off as female. But you've only got to look at the man's body. I mean, the man's got breasts, all the parts of the body. I mean, the man has testicles, and the equivalent in a woman is the ovaries. So they're not two separate things. They're two separate developments from the same thing. Because if you think about it, it all started off as one cell. So I think that men have got to begin to accept their feminine side. That's a process that I had to go through. But it's a process of achieving balance. And I think if we can... Right, let me do something else. I think there is an explosion of conscious awareness going on throughout the world, where people are beginning to become aware of the fact that there is a total imbalance in society, and that imbalance, if allowed to go unchecked, will lead to the extinction of the human race. And until this balance is brought back, until the feminine energy is brought back into balance with the masculine energy, then we are heading for trouble. You know, people say that, you know, we're changing the balance of nature. You can't change the balance of nature. Nature is always in balance. It just adapts to whatever situations. We are changing, if you like, the balance of nature as it applies to humanity. We are changing it potentially to the point where this planet will no longer be suitable for human life. But it won't change the planet. The planet will carry on fine afterwards.
Very true. Now, I'm probably going to stop this soon because I think technology is starting to go away with me a bit here. So I'd just like to thank you so much, Michael. It's really interesting. I had about another three questions for you, but I think I might have another interview with you at some time because I think everyone's going to really like listening to what you've got to say.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening.
I think you've got a lot to share, and I'm really hoping that people will check out your book. So where can people find your book on the I Ching, Michael?
Well, they can find it on Amazon. They can find it on Smashwords. It's available. It's the I Ching, a unique interpretation of the Book of Changes. I'd forgotten the subtitle.
I was going to say, I've got the book in front of me to remind you. And what's on the cards for you now? Have you got anything new? And have you got any other books that you're thinking about writing? Or are you thinking about teaching about the I Ching further? And where can people find you? Do you have a website?
Okay. I have a website that is currently under construction. It should be going public soon. That will be called themichaelfiles.com. And I mean, I've got a page on Facebook, also the Microphiles on Facebook, but I haven't done much with that. I'm not very happy with it, so that's going to have to change. And yes, I do teach a small group of people about the I Ching, and I am in the process of thinking of writing a book which goes rather more deeply into the philosophy behind the I Ching.
That sounds great. And do you think in the future it expand into the digital world? I know you're not exactly a fan of Facebook and tech in that way. Do you think that you'd ever do any I Ching courses on the internet? Because there might be people listening that want to really learn from you and speak to you or watch videos or listen to more audio.
Well, I was thinking, it was your suggestion originally that I should do some videos on the I Ching. And I'm thinking about that. It's not clear what approach I would use. But yes, it's definitely on the cards at some stage.
Because I think definitely from the other I Ching books or the I Ching books that I've seen that you've got, yours is definitely one of the most easiest to read. The rest of them, when you're a beginner, just seem so complex and far too much for anyone that's just learning. I think it's great if you want to be a scholar in the I Ching, but a lot of people might just want to get a basic understanding of it. So I'm really glad that you've written this book and you're going to teach more on this.
I think the reason that it might appeal to people is that instead of getting deeply involved in it, I've taken one aspect of life, one aspect of suffering, if you like, which is the rule of the ego. And I have interpreted the I Ching on the basis of understanding how the ego affects people's lives, how it causes suffering, and how to overcome that. Not by destroying the ego, but as I said earlier, to make it our servant instead of our master.
Fantastic. Thank you, Michael. I hope everyone's enjoyed listening to Michael today, and we'll have you back on in the future, as long as you're open for that.
Okay.
Fantastic. Thank you, Michael. Bye. Well, that was just amazing. I may be slightly biased, but that was just so fascinating and meaningful to me. If you'd like to ask a question for another episode, or you feel like you're a good match as a future guest on Kelly Martin Speaks, email me at kellymartinspeaks@gmail.com or leave a Facebook comment on my Podbean page. Until next time, bye. Thanks for listening to Kelly Martin Speaks. I'd love to reach more people. So if you could subscribe to me on iTunes and leave a review, this really helps. And if you'd like to support my work, pop over to kellymartinspeaks.co.uk to read more, or follow me on social media, or visit my YouTube channel. A donation is always welcome. Thanks, everyone.